From New York, this is Democracy Now!
To hear the words that the Key Bridge has collapsed, it's shocking and heartbreaking.
Six workers who were on the Francis Scott Key Bridge when it collapsed are presumed dead. They hailed from Mexico, Guatemala, El Salvador, and Honduras. We'll go to Baltimore for the latest. Then 200 Texas Tactical Border Force soldiers are deployed in El Paso as tensions rise on the border. But first, the Supreme Court appears likely to preserve access to the abortion pill mifepristone. We'll examine the case and speak with Arizona State Senator Eva Birch. She made headlines last week when she gave a speech on the state Senate floor where she shared her plans to obtain an abortion after receiving news her pregnancy was non-viable.
Generally speaking, people seek abortion for the same reason that I did. I'm choosing abortion because I'm pregnant and for reasons that I should not have to explain to you or to the church or to the state of Arizona. I need to not be pregnant anymore.
All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. The U.S. Supreme Court appears set to preserve access to the abortion pill mifepristone, which is used for roughly two-thirds of all abortions in the United States. Oral arguments were held Tuesday in a case brought by a group of anti-choice medical associations, which have sought to overturn moves by the FDA to increase accessibility to the drug, which was first approved over 20 years ago. On Tuesday, several justices questioned if the doctors even had standing to bring the challenge. Abortion rights activists rallied outside the Supreme Court ahead of the ruling.
This decision should not be held by a couple of justices. It's a decision between a doctor and a family, and that's how it's always been. And let's be clear, it's safe and accessible and has been for over 20 years, with hundreds of thousands of people using this medicine.
We'll have more on the Supreme Court hearing after headlines. The official death toll in Gaza is nearing 32,500 as Israel continues its assault in defiance of a UN Security Council resolution calling for a Ramadan ceasefire. On Monday, an Israeli airstrike killed Sahra Akram Rayan, a longtime correspondent for the Palestinian news agency Wafa. His son was also killed in the attack. By one count, 136 journalists have been killed so far in Gaza. On the humanitarian front, UNICEF's James Elder says the hunger crisis in Gaza is worsening as Palestinian families struggle to find food to eat.
A week ago, I was in Kamal Adwan Hospital, where we've had those reports of 20-plus children dying of malnutrition and dehydration. When I was there, I saw a room full of mothers and carers, not always mothers. Some mothers have been killed. Carers shuddering over children who are paper thin, absolutely paper thin. Incubators full of babies who are born prematurely because of the stress on mothers, also malnourished.
On Tuesday, UN Special Rapporteur Francesca Albanese accused Israel of committing acts of genocide. She spoke in Geneva about her major new report.
Following nearly 6 months of unrelenting Israeli assault on occupied Gaza, it is my solemn duty to report on the worst of what humanity is capable of and to present my finding, the anatomy of a genocide. History teaches us that genocide is a process, not a single act. It starts with the dehumanization of a group as other and the denial of that group's humanity and ends with the destruction of the group in whole or in part. The dehumanization of Palestinians as a group is the hallmark of their history of ethnic cleansing, dispossession, and apartheid.
In Washington, D.C., U.S. Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin met with the Israeli Defense Minister Yoav Gallant Tuesday. Austin said the civilian death toll in Gaza has been, quote, far too high, but he vowed the U.S. would keep arming Israel. A new report by the arms control group SIPRI found 69% of all arms imported by Israel, that's over two-thirds, come from the United States. The group said U.S. weapons, particularly warplanes, have played a major role in Israel's attacks on Gaza and Lebanon. Meanwhile, the State Department spokesperson Matt Miller said the Biden administration's not found Israel's actions in Gaza to be in violation of U.S. or international law.
We have not found them to be in violation of international humanitarian law, either when it comes to the conduct of the war or when it comes to the provision of humanitarian assistance.
President Biden and Vice President Kamala Harris spoke in Raleigh, North Carolina, Tuesday. A group of pro-Palestinian activists interrupted the president while he talked about his record on health care.
A patient with a heart disease, diabetes, or a child with asthma couldn't get coverage. Why? Because the insurance company considered those a pre-existing condition that allowed them to deny coverage.
What about the health care in Gaza?
Everybody deserves health care. They have a point. We need to get a lot more care into Gaza.
In Lebanon, seven paramedics have died in an Israeli airstrike on an emergency health center in the town of Habreya. Lebanon's health ministry condemned the attack as a violation of the Geneva Convention. Hezbollah responded by firing dozens of rockets into northern Israel. One factory worker reportedly died in Israel. Authorities in Maryland fear six missing construction workers died on Tuesday when the Francis Scott Key Bridge partially collapsed after a massive cargo ship crashed into a support column. Just prior to the accident, the crew on the 95,000-ton cargo ship sent an urgent Mayday call after the ship lost power, possibly due to contaminated fuel. The warning gave authorities on land the chance to limit bridge traffic, but eight construction workers were still on the bridge where they'd been fixing potholes. Only two of the workers were rescued on Tuesday. The missing workers include a Salvadoran father of three named Miguel Luna, a Honduran father of two named Menor Yasir Suazo Sandova, two Guatemalan men, and at least one Mexican national. We'll have more on this story later in the show. A court in Russia has extended Wall Street Journal reporter Evan Gershkovich's pretrial detention until at least June 30th. Friday will mark 1 year since Evan was detained on espionage charges while he was on a reporting trip. Police in India detained dozens of protesters Tuesday as they attempted to march to Prime Minister Narendra Modi's residence in New Delhi. The protest came in response to last week's arrest of Delhi Chief Minister Arvind Kejriwal, who's a prominent critic of Modi. This all comes as part of a political crackdown ahead of national elections in India, which begin in April. The New York judge presiding over Donald Trump's hush money trial has imposed a partial gag order on the former president, barring him from attacking witnesses, jurors, court staff, and others. In his order, Judge Juan Merchan noted Trump's history of making, quote, threatening, inflammatory, and denigrating comments. The criminal trial begins April 15th. NBC News has reversed its decision to hire Ronna McDaniel, the former chair of the Republican National Committee. Her hiring sparked a rare on-air revolt by many of the top anchors on NBC and MSNBC over her role in spreading Donald Trump's lies about the 2020 election. In campaign news, independent presidential candidate Robert F. Kennedy Jr. has tapped the massively wealthy Silicon Valley attorney Nicole Shanahan to be his running mate. Shanahan's the former wife of Google co-founder Sergey Brin. She gave over $4 million to fund a controversial Super Bowl ad for Kennedy, which resembled a 1960 commercial by his uncle John F. Kennedy. Robert F. Kennedy Jr.'s run for the White House has been widely condemned by other members of the Kennedy family, in part due to his longtime advocacy against vaccines. Dozens of members of the extended Kennedy family met with Joe Biden at the White House last week to show their support for his reelection. And more details are coming to light about the federal probe into the music mogul Sean Diddy Combs. On Monday, federal agents raided his homes in Los Angeles and Miami. The investigation is being led by a team at the Department of Homeland Security, which focuses on human trafficking. In recent months, Combs has faced five separate lawsuits over sexual misconduct, including one lawsuit by a woman who accused Combs of raping her and forcing her into sex trafficking. Combs' lawyers have issued a statement proclaiming his innocence while criticizing federal agents for using what they called military-level force during the house raids. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman in New York, joined by Democracy Now! Co-host Juan Gonzalez in Chicago. Hi, Juan.
Hi, Amy, and welcome to all of our listeners and viewers across the country and around the world.
The U.S. Supreme Court appears likely to preserve access to the abortion pill mifepristone, which is used for roughly two-thirds of all U.S. abortions. Oral arguments were held Tuesday on the Biden administration's appeal of lower court rulings, which restricted access to the pill, including its availability by mail. The case was brought by a group of anti-choice medical associations, which have sought to overturn moves by the FDA to increase accessibility to the drug, which was approved by the FDA over 20 years ago. This was the first abortion-related Supreme Court hearing since the court overturned Roe v. Wade in 2022. Since then, medications to terminate pregnancies have increased in importance because patients can get them by mail and take them at home, including in states that have severely limited or banned abortions. A decision on the case is expected by July. For more, we're joined by Michelle Goodwin, professor of constitutional law and global health policy at Georgetown University and founding director of the Center for Biotechnology and Global Health Policy. She's author of Policing the Womb, Invisible Women and the Criminalization of Motherhood, joining us from Washington, D.C. Professor Goodwin, welcome back to Democracy Now! First, give us your overall impression of the oral arguments before the Supreme Court and where the justices stood across the political spectrum in questioning, in doing their questioning.
First, it's great to be back with you. Overall, the justices showed that they were skeptical of the claims brought by the plaintiffs in this case, a group of individuals who call themselves doctors who claim that they have been affected negatively by mifepristone being in the marketplace. They claim that it is a drug that was rushed to the marketplace by the Food and Drug Administration and that it is unsafe. And because, as they say, it is unsafe, then they will be put in a position of having to treat individuals who have been harmed by this drug, who appear in hospitals and emergency rooms. But it's important to unpack their claims. First of all, they rely on three studies, two of which have been retracted, and one of which was just a collection of anonymous blog posts. The second thing is that when the Food and Drug Administration brought this drug to the marketplace for approval, it had been under review for 54 months, three times the length of other drugs that were approved that very same year, over 20 years ago, as you noted. The third thing is that over decades of research, both in the United States and abroad, it is clear that mifepristone is incredibly safe, safer even than Tylenol. That is to say that the negative indications that would cause a person to need medical care is less than what people would experience by taking Tylenol. But these are the kinds of claims that have been out in the social atmosphere. The justices were incredibly skeptical, even with regard to just the question of standing. Amongst these individuals who are claimed to be doctors, one is a person who has a master's degree in theology, no MD, likely a person that would not be admitted into any hospital to be able to provide any care to anybody. Another is a dentist, again, a person who would likely never be in a hospital allowed to treat anyone. Amongst that group of seven then come down to two who make claims that they would be most affected, called into emergency rooms to help this abundance of people who would be appearing because they would have complications due to using mifepristone. But they had no record, and the justices really pushed them. Justice Ketanji Brown Jackson really pushed, give us facts. Tell us that actually this has ever happened where one of your plaintiffs has been put in the position of having to help someone because they had complications due to mifepristone, and they couldn't come up with that. On the other hand, the lawyer for these individuals kept claiming that it would be a potentiality in the future, that there would be a probability in the future because more people are using mifepristone. Now, to just be clear, it's not the case that people don't come to a hospital after they use mifepristone. Some people might, but the question is, when they come in, are they in a dire medical situation where they actually need care? And this is an important distinction because the Food and Drug Administration did acknowledge that there are people who use mifepristone and who go to a hospital. But this is natural because they have been bleeding. It's not been because they have been in medical crisis. People go to ER when they have colds and when they have the flu as well. It doesn't mean that they are dying or that there is the kind of medical crisis that would qualify this drug to be one that should not be on the marketplace. That was the general overview. Skepticism from Justices Gorsuch, Kavanaugh, Amy Coney Barrett, Sotomayor, Kagan, and as well, Justice Ketanji Brown Jackson. So not a good day for those who are pushing this anti-abortion agenda. But let me say one additional thing. Comstock was brought up by Justice Thomas, and we might want to talk a bit about that. It's a centuries-old law that has not been repealed by Congress, but has not been used by Congress in 100 years. And it's the next line of strategy that might be used by those who have an anti-abortion stance. What the Comstock Act does is it prohibits contraception and abortifacients from being mailed by the U.S. Postal Service or by carriers.
And Michelle Goodwin, what parts of the FDA's authority to regulate mifepristone are being challenged by these plaintiffs?
Well, this was the mystery even for the members of the United States Supreme Court. Justice Ketanji Brown Jackson put it quite squarely to both the government lawyer as well as the general prelogger, as well as the lawyer for the group. It's strange, as Justice Ketanji Brown Jackson said, well, who's to decide in these cases? Do we leave these matters to the Food and Drug Administration, where there are scientists who are trained to do these kinds of reviews, to hold to account the pharmaceutical industry, people who have the capacity, the knowledge, the experience to review the data that comes in from both the pharmaceutical industry and as well the data collected by the government? Who's best qualified, those individuals, or would it be judges and justices? And she made note of the fact that with the evidence presented by the plaintiffs in this case, which included anonymous blog post, and that to serve as credible evidence before Judge Kaczmarek in Amarillo, Texas, basically showing, you know, the emperor has no clothes, that judges are not in the best position to review this scientific data and evidence. And for the alliance that who brought this suit in the first place, they really had no response to that.
Justice Ketanji Brown Jackson asked the lawyer representing the mifepristone manufacturer, Danko, to lay out her concerns about judges parsing medical and scientific studies about pharmaceuticals. This was attorney's Jessica Ellsworth's response.
You have a district court that, among other things, relied on one study that was an analysis of anonymous blog posts. You have another set of studies that he relied on that were not in the administrative record and would never be because they post-date the FDA decisions here. They have since been retracted for lack of scientific rigor and for misleading presentations of data. Those sorts of errors can infect judicial analyses precisely because judges are not experts in statistics. They are not experts in the methodology used for scientific studies, for clinical trials. That is why FDA has many hundreds of pages of analysis in the record of what the scientific data showed, and courts are just not in a position to parse through and second-guess that.
And this is Justice Thomas mentioning the Comstock Act when questioning Aaron Hawley, the lawyer representing the abortion pills challengers.
Ms. Hawley, I'm sure you heard the answers of the Solicitor General and the counsel for Danko with respect to the Comstock Act. I'd like you to comment on their answers.
Sure, Justice Thomas. We don't think that there's any case of this court that empowers FDA to ignore other federal law. With respect to the Comstock Act is relevant here. The Comstock Act says that drugs should not be mailed through the mail or through common carriers. So we think that the plain text of that, Your Honor, is pretty clear.
Aaron Hawley now becomes one of the only women ever to argue a prominent abortion case at the Supreme Court for the anti-abortion side. This is her first Supreme Court argument. Her husband is Senator Josh Hawley, the Republican of Missouri, who was in the courtroom for the oral arguments. I mean, the significance of what she's saying, and if you can talk more about who the doctors were who brought the case against mifepristone and the whole discussion that took place in the court around the issue of dentists.
Well, you know, let's back up to Danko, the manufacturer who has a stake in this, as do other pharmaceutical manufacturers. There is a concern that if this case were allowed to go forward, including with the very attenuated individuals who claim that there is somehow standing, that's very attenuated in this case, in order to have standing, and this was a prominent issue discussed yesterday under Article 3 of the Constitution, one must have some skin in the game. One must have been affected by the law, the regulation, what's in place. One must show that they have been harmed by it and that somehow the court is able to provide the kind of relief that they need. The first thing is it's very, very hard to show that these are individuals who have been affected negatively by mifepristone being in the marketplace because, as was raised by the justices, these individuals can opt out. The federal government recognizes individuals' conscience, and that is that doctors, and not only doctors, even people who are pharmacists, nurses, can claim that they have a religious objection to performing certain types of medical care. A pharmacist can have a religious objection to dispensing certain types of care. And what the justices walked them through, the lawyers, was that those individuals usually go through a process. They let their pharmacy know. They let their hospital know such that they're not even called upon when there are cases that present of which they would not want to provide care. In this case, Aaron Hawley said that that was not enough. It was just simply not enough that these individuals would be able to exempt themselves out. And in fact, she seemed to suggest that there would be somehow complications at hospitals where somehow, even though they had exempted themselves out, that somehow they would still be called upon in order to help in cases of managing a miscarriage or an abortion. That is really important to note because it gets back to this question of standing. Now, as to the other issues with regard to these doctors, the so-called doctors in this case, well, that, you know, relates. Of the seven, it really boiled down to only two who are obstetricians, gynecologists, who might be in a hospital performing some care, obstetric care or gynecological care. But as Justice Ketanji Brown Jackson noted, that the kind of relief that they seek in this case is totally disproportionate to who they are and relief for them, because the relief already exists, and that is the fact that they can just be exempted from providing any kind of care in an emergency room that might relate to somebody who needs to manage a miscarriage. It was interesting that Justice Amy Coney Barrett also made another clarification, and that is to say that these individuals would not know if they were called in, necessarily know that when they have been called in for emergency care to evacuate a uterus, that it was because someone necessarily took mifepristone. And then there was discussion about about that, including Amy Coney Barrett asking questions with regard to ultrasounds and matters on that note.
And Michelle Goodwin, could you talk about the group behind this this alliance, the so-called Alliance of Doctors, the Alliance Defending Freedom?
Well, yes, this is a group. Well, to level set a bit, there has been for some time now an infusion, significant infusion of finances, of money that has gone into defeating Roe v. Wade, Planned Parenthood v. Casey, and a legacy of cases that affirmed Roe v. Wade. And that's important for listeners to know, because in the Dobbs decision, when Justice Alito, in writing that opinion, he seemed to suggest that out of nowhere there was Roe, and then there was Planned Parenthood v. Casey, and otherwise there's no legacy of reproductive rights before the court. That's just not accurate. 40 years before Roe, 30 years before Roe, Skinner v. Oklahoma, the Supreme Court had said that determining your own reproductive future is a human right, it's a civil right, it's a civil liberty. That was a case that involved a man. And then after Roe, there were a legion of cases that continued to affirm Roe. That said, what we have now is an alliance that has been deeply funded, that's been attempting to chip away at abortion rights, both federally and also state by state. Involved in the Dobbs case, involved in the Texas litigation, the legislation that overturned abortion rights in that state, they are very active, and they're seeking to also then interfere with the federal government, seeking to use EMTALA as a means of helping individuals who are in emergency situations who also need to terminate pregnancy. So it's worth noting that this particular organization is not just involved with this particular case, but it is part of a movement afoot, a well-funded movement that is seeking to not only undermine abortion rights, but also seeking to undermine other reproductive freedoms that people truly care about, including access to contraception.
And we just have 15 seconds, Professor Goodwin, but were you surprised by the tone of the questions? And do you think they're headed toward allowing mifepristone?
I believe that they are towards allowing mifepristone to remain in the marketplace, because the risk is that any other group that would like to have a drug or a vaccine removed from the marketplace could forum shop for the right kind of judge that might lean into what is information that is inaccurate and grant standing to individuals and potentially risk important vaccines from being removed from the U.S. marketplace, which would be a risk to us all, to children, to adults, and also globally.
Michelle Goodwin, professor of constitutional law and global health policy at Georgetown University, founding director of the Center for Biotechnology and Global Health Policy, host of the Ms. Magazine podcast On the Issues with Michelle Goodwin, and author of Policing the Womb, Invisible Women and the Criminalization of Motherhood. In 2021, her guest essay for The New York Times was headlined, "I Was Raped by My Father and Abortion Saved My Life." Up next, a state legislator in Arizona speaks from the Senate floor explaining why she's about to have an abortion. Just back from that abortion, she'll talk about why it was so important to take her personal agonizing decision public. Stay with us.
She's been a fixture as long as I've lived here. Caught almost every night for the last 6 years. She's not there, she's not there. When she's not there, I worry about her. Think of all of the women, all of the women, all of the women who disappear.
All of the Women by Alison Russell. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. As we continue on the issue of reproductive rights, we're joined by Democratic Arizona State Senator Eva Birch. Last week, she made headlines when she gave a speech on the floor of the Arizona State Senate where she shared her plans to get an abortion after receiving news that her pregnancy was non-viable. State Senator Birch spoke about her struggles with fertility and miscarriage she had over a decade ago.
2 years ago, while I was campaigning for this Senate seat, I became pregnant with what we later determined was a non-viable pregnancy. It was a pregnancy that we had been trying for, and we were heartbroken over it. But now, I wish I could tell you otherwise, but after numerous ultrasounds and blood draws, we have determined that my pregnancy is once again not progressing and is not viable. And once again, I have scheduled an appointment to terminate my pregnancy. I don't think people should have to justify their abortions, but I'm choosing to talk about why I made this decision, because I want us to be able to have meaningful conversations about the reality of how the work that we do in this body impacts people in the real world.
That's Arizona State Senator Eva Birch, a former nurse practitioner who worked at a women's health clinic and has been widely critical of abortion restrictions in Arizona, where abortions are banned after 15 weeks of pregnancy, no exceptions for rape or incest. State Senator Eva Birch is joining us now from Phoenix. We welcome you to Democracy Now! And let me start by saying you publicly announced plans last week to have an abortion. I can't believe we're talking about this globally. Did you have the procedure? And what was it like to have to make this public to everyone? And as you did this, Republicans walked out of the state Senate.
Good morning. Thank you for having me on the show today. You know, I felt like it was really important for me to bring people along so that people could really see what this looks like. I'm at this critical intersection in the abortion conversation because I've been a healthcare provider, I've been a patient seeking abortion care, and now as a lawmaker, I knew that my perspective was unique, and I wanted to share that. I wanted to pull people into the conversation so that we could be more honest about what abortion care looks like in Arizona, but this is happening all over the country, and who the abortion patient is, and really try to break through some of the stigma and some of the misunderstanding about abortion care and hopefully move the needle in the right direction.
And Senator, could you talk about how your profession as a health provider and a nurse practitioner has influenced your approach, the conversations perhaps you've had with other women in similar situations?
Certainly, I worked in the reproductive health care space for some time. I don't work in abortion care because that's not something that's available to me as a nurse practitioner, but I have had patients who were pregnant, who had questions, patients who were concerned about whether or not Arizona is a hospitable environment for someone who's pregnant, patients who are unsure about whether or not continuing their pregnancy is the right decision for them. And we have to counsel them with the understanding that our laws here are in flux, that abortion care is not guaranteed in Arizona by any means, not only for patients who are just uncertain about whether or not they want to continue their pregnancy, but for patients who might be experiencing complications in their pregnancy or pregnancy loss the way that I was.
You spoke.
And could you
go ahead, Juan.
Can you talk about the reaction since you made your announcement from other members of the Senate, as well as protesters, how you and your family have coped with that?
Yes, I have had an overwhelmingly positive response. It has really been moving for me. I have had people sending me letters to the legislature. I have had emails and messages and direct messages on social media to the tune of thousands. And what I'm mostly receiving are people telling me their own stories or just thanking me for giving them a seat at the table. I think that people really don't want to bring people along with them with their abortion experiences. This is highly personal and it's a little bit taboo. And often it's a sensitive subject. People don't want to talk about it, but they want to be heard. And I think people are just really grateful for this opportunity to pull people in and to have a voice, to have a seat at the table. Now, as far as the reaction within the legislature, I haven't had any of my Republican colleagues reach out to me to talk about this, not in the way that maybe I would have hoped for, but I wasn't overly optimistic about that. It wasn't so much about trying to convince my colleagues as much as it was about trying to bring light to what's happening in Arizona so that our constituents can make decisions for themselves and hopefully get engaged in the political process and help us to elect pro-choice candidates up and down the ticket. That's really what we need in Arizona and in this country to make real change.
In one of the articles, many about you, State Senator Birch, they said, you said that I was told I could choose adoption. I was told I could choose parenting, which were two things that I couldn't choose. It was cruel to suggest that that was an option for me when it's not. If you could explain that, then also what it was like to have these Republicans walk out on you, one of them, a female state legislator, walking in thinking you were done with your speech, then walking out for the second time.
Yes. So I think that a lot of people don't really understand the ways that laws can be sort of weaponized against patients, not to necessarily ban abortion, but to make abortion inaccessible or a difficult experience, to create a hostile environment in the abortion clinic, to create confusion in the patient and provider relationship. And we have a lot of that in Arizona. There is this mandatory counseling where they have to talk about adoption and parenting as alternatives to abortion, which of course is not always relevant to patients, which is why it should be medical providers who are determining the appropriate counseling for their patients. They also have to talk about the probable physical and anatomical properties of the fetus at the time that your abortion will take place, which again, certainly in my case, but in general, is inappropriate and unnecessary. And my pregnancy was not progressing. My embryo was dying and not subject to the probabilities of a normal, healthy pregnancy. So that information was also just factually inaccurate for me. But that's what the providers are required to do because of out-of-touch legislators who don't have any medical professional experience, who are writing the laws and dictating what doctors have to say to patients in that environment. As far as my Republican colleagues filtering in and out and not really listening to what I had to say, I have a couple of thoughts on that. One of them is just that I think that these laws are intended to do what they did. So I don't think that they are surprised by it or concerned about it. I think that really it just reinforces that what they're doing with these laws is having the intended impact. So I don't think that there's necessarily any need for my Republican colleagues to hear what I have to say, because they're not going to make any changes or do things any differently because of that. I will also say that I have good relationships with a number of my Republican colleagues. We disagree on a lot of things. It's really the leadership in the Arizona Senate that is so skewed far to the right. They are extremists, and they really have sort of set themselves up for failure in that way. But I didn't experience anything that I wasn't expecting in the chamber that day.
We just have 30 seconds. If you could respond to the mifepristone oral arguments in the Supreme Court.
Yes. I mean, I can't believe we're even talking about it, to be honest with you. I mean, mifepristone has, what is it, 26 years of safety data and is extremely safe and effective medication. I think that we cannot be setting this precedent where we are allowing religious or extremist organizations to be able to go to highly partisan Trump-appointed judges and bring a case all the way up to the Supreme Court. I just really hope that they do the right thing. It's unimaginable that this is where we are with the mifepristone case. We use this medication so much more safely than so many medications that you can buy over the counter. It's an outrageous conversation that we're having with this, but I am hoping that the right decision will be made. But it just goes to show how serious the consequences are when we have someone like Trump, who is designing a highest court in the land for the people of this country. And we have to be so conscious of that and to work so hard to make sure that we are making better decisions in November.
Eva Birch, Democratic Arizona State Senator, nurse practitioner, announced in her speech on the state Senate floor that she planned to get an abortion last week to call attention to the restrictions she and others now face. When we come back to Baltimore, where six workers were on the Francis Scott Key Bridge when it collapsed are presumed dead, from Mexico, Guatemala, El Salvador, and Honduras. Stay with us.
El aire en suspenso y medieval, con orillas afiladas, las estrellas igual de monstruos y comprensibles.
Noche, Nighttime by Fuensanta. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Authorities in Maryland fear six missing construction workers died on Tuesday when the Francis Scott Key Bridge collapsed after a massive cargo ship crashed into a support column. Maryland's governor said the crew on the ship was able to issue an emergency May Day call before colliding with the bridge, which allowed authorities to stop incoming traffic. This is audio from Broadcastify.com archive of Maryland Transportation Authority first responder radio traffic just before the bridge collapsed.
Yeah, if we can stop traffic, just make sure no one's on the bridge right now. I'm not sure where there's a crew up there. You might want to notify whoever the foreman is, see if we can get them off the bridge temporarily.
10-4, once the other unit gets here, I'll ride up on the bridge. I have all interloop traffic stopped at this time. But once you get here, I'll go grab the workers on the Key Bridge and then stop the outer loop.
C-13 dispatch, the whole bridge just fell down. Everybody, the whole bridge just collapsed.
Authorities are still investigating the cause of the crash, but say the ship leaving Baltimore Harbor lost propulsion and control of vessel around 1:30 a.m. Tuesday. The crew of men who were filling potholes on the bridge were from Mexico, Guatemala, El Salvador, and Honduras, had been in this country for many years. They include Salvadoran father of three named Miguel Luna, Honduran father of two named Menor Yasser Suazo Sandoval, two Guatemalan men, and at least one Mexican national. In a minute, we'll speak with Maximilian Alvarez, editor-in-chief of the Baltimore-based news outlet The Real News, who's been reporting on the bridge collapse. On Wednesday, he interviewed Jesus Campos, who's Salvadoran and works for Bronner Builders, the company that employed the workers on the bridge.
We do concrete repair on the bridge. We remove the damaged concrete and put new concrete. That is what we do at the company.
At night, with fewer cars?
Yes, with less traffic. We enter at 9 p.m. until 5 a.m. That is the time they give us. But we have worked there for a long time, and there has never been a mishap like what happened.
Yes, it was a horrible disaster. Do you know if the workers got any warning?
No.
No, I understand they were on their half-hour break that they give them, like they were inside the trucks. There were four trucks or five trucks that have to be on site. They were inside the trucks, supposedly.
For more, we're joined by Maximilian Alvarez, editor-in-chief of The Real News, based in Baltimore. Welcome to Democracy Now! Condolences to your city. And if you can start off by talking about what you've learned about these workers. I mean, the warning did go out, albeit there was just a few minutes, enough time to stop all the traffic from going over the bridge. Talk about what more you understand about these men. Eight, two have been saved, one in critical condition, and six presumed dead.
Well, thank you so much for having me. It's an honor to be here. But as you rightly said, you know, our hearts are broken today here in Baltimore. There's a hole in our hearts as big as the gap where the bridge used to be, and there's a hole in these families that will never be filled again. And that's really what's first and foremost on our minds today. And there's still a lot that needs to be learned and investigated about this story. But as you mentioned, what we know and what Jesus Campos told me yesterday and what I've seen from other reports coming out is that, you know, these workers who work for Bronner Builders, you know, a contractor that's been in operation for decades and contracts with the state of Maryland on many other projects, you know, that these workers were working with Bronner in the middle of the night to fix potholes on the Key Bridge. The men who we believe now to be dead, six of whom, you know, like were on that bridge, were, according to Jesus, on their 30-minute lunch break, sitting in their cars or near their cars when the bridge itself collapsed. When I asked Jesus if he knew that if the crew received any warning about the Mayday call, he told me very explicitly, no, they did not. And I believe that we hear that in the police dispatcher, right? The police knew that there was no direct line to the foreman and to the folks on that bridge. And so the police were racing to block traffic coming in on either side of the bridge and were waiting for backup so that one of the officers could go onto the bridge and warn the crew. But every second that, you know, went by, you know, was a second lost, and they did not have time to reach the crew on the bridge. But I think the more egregious problem and the question we should be asking about is why the folks on that bridge doing that dangerous work in the middle of the night had no direct line to emergency dispatch when they are clearly working in a potentially hazardous environment and these massive mega, you know, ships are passing beneath their feet. And so far, that's what we know. I mean, like, there are, again, like, details that need to be confirmed, but, you know, like, there's a lot in this story that will appear different if you, you know, don't know construction workers, don't know a lot of immigrants, don't know a lot of undocumented immigrants. Just one example, and I'm not saying this is exactly what happened, but I'm saying that I've watched a lot of local news in the city over the past 24 hours, and there were reportedly two workers who were pulled alive from the water yesterday, one of whom went to the hospital, one who reportedly refused emergency care, refused transport to the hospital. And so anchors have been saying, well, I guess that person was fine and they just went home. That may be the case. But again, if you know workers in construction, you know immigrants and undocumented folks, your mind immediately thinks that was a worker who was deathly afraid of going to the hospital because they may be undocumented. And, like, that's a situation that so many workers in this country are actually in right now. And I can only imagine, after going through that, if that was the case, what must be going through a person's mind to refuse emergency services at that moment. So there's still a lot to be uncovered, but right now the families are grieving, the fellow workers are grieving. Jesus was largely in shock when I talked to him, and I was very emotional afterwards, having talked to him as well. You know, my foster daughter is from Honduras. She's undocumented. She's sharing posts with me all day from Honduras of people trying to figure out if these were their family members. It's devastating, Amy.
Maximilian, I wanted to ask you this issue of Latino workers and immigrant workers being killed or injured on the job has been a national problem and almost epidemic for years that hasn't been given little attention. 18% of all workers in the United States are Latinos, but 23% of the fatalities in workplaces are among Latinos and disproportionately among immigrant workers. Your response to this, these facts, vis-a-vis the constant, what we hear in the media all the time about migrants being criminals and being a danger to society?
I appreciate the question, Juan, and I think this is really important. This is something I want to really stress for people. I mean, first and foremost, as you said, you know, the reason that so many folks are reaching out because they feel connected to this story, even though this was a unique, horrible accident, there are so many elements in this story that people, working people around the country, feel connected to. I was just in East Palestine, Ohio this weekend. I've had residents there texting me all day because they feel connected to this in a way. And I've had construction workers and building trades folks doing the same. Why? Because construction is still one of the most deadliest jobs in this country, far deadlier than police, right? I mean, we just last year, six crewmen on a
construction crew were killed when a car in Baltimore County, when a car barreled into them. That's just as many who died yesterday. And each one of those lives is precious, and we should care just as much about those lives that are lost. We're killing over 10 times as many construction workers just by roadside accidents around this country every year alone. Those lives matter too. But as you mentioned, Juan, I mean, like, this is not just about, you know, construction workers. This is not just about contractors and all of that. I mean, the problem is so much bigger here, and it really goes to the heart of the discourse that we're having in this country, where, you know, Donald Trump and the people who have been poisoned by, you know, like his like evil rhetoric and anti-immigrant stances, you know, they are vilifying people who look like me, people who look like Jesus, people like the men on that bridge, people like my foster daughter and her friends and her boyfriend who works construction, right? That could have been us. That could have been any one of us. And we Jesus and I knew that when we were talking to each other. And, you know, I think that the thing that, like, is really important to stress to people is, like, we are not coming to this country to ruin it. We're not the evil people. We're not the enemies. We're workers just like you. We're neighbors, right? While we're being talked about as, like, this invading horde that's coming to destroy the country, what does this story actually show us? That immigrants are filling our potholes at night so that we can have a smooth drive to work in the morning. Immigrant workers are, and the contractors who employ them and exploit the contracting relationship, which happens all across the country, that's why you find brown kids, you know, children working in meatpacking plants, cleaning bone saws in the middle of the night. That's why you find children, primarily brown migrant children who should be in school, working in Hyundai parts distributors in Alabama. And yet Hyundai can say it's not responsible for that because it's a contractor, subcontractor, yada, yada, yada. This goes so much deeper. There are workers like this who are working in slave-like conditions in our country right now, picking the tomatoes that go on your Wendy's hamburger. And yet we are contributing to this country. We want to make a better life for ourselves and our families, just like the families who are grieving right now because those six men are never going to come home. Like, we are not your enemy. We are your fellow workers. We are your neighbors. Our children are your children's friends in school. And I hope more than anything that people can see this and see the humanity in us and see that this idea that immigrants are somehow destroying our country when, you know, like, corporate greed and all the corruption is causing catastrophes from East Palestine to Boeing to what have you. Like, the enemies are clear. We are not it. We are just here trying to make a life for our families and work and make and live a comfortable, dignified life. And I don't know why that's such a hard thing for so much of the country to understand.
Well, Max, I want to thank you so much for being with us. We'd like to ask you to stay beyond the end of the show so we can conduct this interview in Spanish and put it on our website in Spanish. Maximilian Alvarez, editor-in-chief of The Real News, based in Baltimore, Maryland. This is Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. We're ending today's show in Texas, where some 200 tactical Border Force soldiers with the Texas National Guard were deployed in El Paso Tuesday. This comes after Texas erected a second border fence covered in razor wire Friday, and riot police attacked migrants who tried to pull it down. The federal spending bill Biden signed into law this weekend increases funding for ICE and Customs and Border Patrol. This also comes as Texas's harsh new anti-immigrant state law was put back on hold by the Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals last week after the Supreme Court briefly lifted a stay, SB4 giving local police sweeping powers to arrest and deport anyone they suspect of entering the United States without authorization. For more, we go to El Paso, where we're joined by Fernando Garcia, founder and executive director of Border Network for Human Rights. Fernando, welcome back to Democracy Now! Can you talk about these 200 soldiers that have been deployed to the border and also the whole debate over SB4 that almost went into effect if the Supreme Court had their way, then didn't because of a lower court ruling?
Hey, good morning, Amy and Juan. Yes, thanks for having me again. Listen, I mean, we have a very a situation at the border where the state of Texas is massively militarizing our community, especially here in El Paso, but also in the rest of the Mexico-Texas border. Just to give you a little bit of context already, is that we had the state of Texas has deployed 10,000 state soldiers already, the National Guard troops in our communities, especially along the border, and now we see an increase of that militarization, and I think we're very concerned, specifically having special troops or special forces coming to El Paso with no training on how to deal with civilian population and much less dealing with immigrants and children and refugees. So I think this is just, again, the effort of the state of Texas to usurp the federal powers of especially enforcing border enforcement laws or, in this case, immigration laws. So again, we believe that it's not only illegal what the state of Texas is doing, but also it is violating many people's rights, especially in El Paso region.
And Fernando, could you talk about the decision by President Lopez Obrador in Mexico? He blasted Texas's SB4 law and said that Mexico won't accept anyone deported under that law?
Yes, yes. And to be very clear, what the state of Texas has done immigration enforcement and deportation system, from actually allowing the police officers, state police, ask immigration status, show me your papers questions, but also detain, arrest members in the community in Texas, especially Latino members, and then a state magistrate, a state judge, would decide the deportation of that person that was arrested. And this is impacting not only migrants or refugees that are coming across the border, but also everybody in Texas, whether they're, you're in Houston, in Dallas, in Fort Worth, so everybody would be subjected to as before. So what President Lopez Obrador did he said essentially that he's not recognizing the authority of Texas to actually enforce federal immigration laws and start deporting either Mexicanos, Salvadoreños, or any other immigrants back to Mexico. So I think that was the right decision. But however, the state of Texas is still building up this immigration state force.
And also, the new spending bill that President Biden just signed, it provides a massive increase to ICE detention infrastructure and for more money for the Customs and Border Patrol and ICE. Your response?
Well, that is unfortunate, again, I mean, because we know what some extremist politicians like Mr. Greg Abbott is doing already in Texas, which, by the way, other states now are trying to mirror as before, in Georgia and Louisiana. And the fact that the federal government doesn't have an alternative to that, doesn't have not only an alternative policy, but also an alternative narrative to this so-called invasion of criminals, the way that migrants are being portrayed, it just add to the problems, because we don't need more detention centers in the interior or at the border. We don't need more Border Patrol, as is in the DHS funding that was just approved. What we needed was more welcoming centers. We needed more accountability and oversight to federal law enforcement at the border, but also we needed for the federal government to stop Texas, stop the governor of what they are doing in terms of enforcing illegally and unconstitutionally, as before, that is impacting Latinos, people of color, migrants that are looking for asylum and protection. I mean, what you saw in El Paso, the pictures of people running through the barbed wire, it is how desperate the situation is at the border. Because these state soldiers, barbed wire, and this state enforcement, it is illegally impeding migrants and families to ask for asylum, which is the right, it's an international right, it's granted in the U.S. Constitution. So I think that we expected the administration to be more forceful in accomplishing more humane and border and push for immigration reform. We had not seen that. Instead, we had seen more militarization and more resources for detention centers coming from the administration also.
Ando, we want to thank you for being with us and ask you to stay after the show to conduct this interview in Spanish. Fernando Garcia, founder and executive director of the Border Network for Human Rights, based in El Paso, Texas. That does it for our show, Democracy Now!, produced with Mike Burke, Renee Feltz, Dina Guzder, Sharif Abdelkaddous, Messiah Rhodes, Nermeen Sheikh, Maria Tarasena, Tammy Warnoff, Tarina Nadura, Sam Alkoff, Tame Maria Studio, Rabbi Karen, Hani Masood, and Hannah Elias. Our executive director is Julie Crosby. Special thanks to Becca Staley, John Randolph, Paul Powell, Mike DeFilippo, Miguel Noguera. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez.